Well, I'm a big fan of old slipware, which I find really charming more than anything, actually. And I like the idea of using clay that isn't precious, I think is the word that I would use. I kind of like its raw edges. I like the feel of terracotta. I love it when you fire it super high and it goes a really beautiful, rich, sort of dark brown. And then you've got this. It's very difficult to add color onto that surface. So I started sort of introducing basically it's slip.
Hi, I'm Bob Acton, and welcome to the Color and Ceramics Podcast. Today, we're lucky to have Mish Falano on the show. She's an outstanding potter in the United Kingdom who does beautiful work with slips and color and images on terracotta clay. We talked about her journey in clay, her surface design methods, how she engages her spirit in her work, and some advice she has for potters. You'll find links to her website and social media in the show notes. So let's get to the interview.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Well, Mish, thank you for joining me today, and welcome to the Color and Ceramics podcast to talk about color and surface design. I really love your work. I love the beautiful ceramic pieces that you have with the sketching that you, the colorful sketching that you have on it, and the white slip. I assume it's white slip that you
It
have
is.
on the dark on the dark clay, because I think that really makes things pop. And so welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the beauty we see and feel when we approach your pieces really represents years of hard work. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming the artist you are today.
It's rather a long journey that's been broken up into, you know, a fair few pieces, but it kind of started at school. So back in the early 80s, I left school, and because there were no jobs, I decided that I would take on a college course. Where I fell in love with clay more than anything. And that took me on to a foundation course, which then took me on to do a degree. And I did my degree in woods, metals, ceramics, and plastics in Brighton, UK. But that got sort of stopped short after 2 years because funding changed in the UK. So a lot of people couldn't actually finish their degrees. Which and I was one of them, but I still knew that that was something I was definitely going to pursue at some point in my life. Well, to fast forward a few years, I took a job working in a graphics department for a small company, which when everything was very analog, there was no computers, it was all daisy wheel printers and bromide cameras, and was very hands-on. That suited me really well. But unfortunately, after about 6 years working there, the owner was tragically killed. So I kind of lost my job there. And then I went to work for another company called XArt, which we had this sort of mobile phone revolution happening. And I was employed by, they were a subsidiary of Nokia. And so my graphics got very grounded at that point. And I was working for all the Premier League football clubs, designing their mobile phone fascias. I'm sure you remember the old 3210s and 7110s where you clipped the fronts and backs onto phones. Well, a lot of those I was responsible for. And I hold my hands up. So I got involved with graphics in quite a big way, actually. And I really enjoyed doing it, although it was very two-dimensional. It was something that I think my love of print and my love of colour, because obviously, especially with Premier League clubs and Formula One racing and not particularly the things that I was interested in, but I did like playing around with all the text and the badges and the, it was like you're collaging constantly on two dimensions, which I sort of loved. And then in 2008, I had the opportunity to go back to college and leave work. And so I found a course where I could rekindle my love in clay, really. And I found a part-time course that was doing a foundation degree. I went along there to get like a portfolio together and to sort of reinvest myself into that material. But in the background, there was all this stuff that I'd learned from graphics and input, you know, was just going in and it was sort of coming out on the clay badly at that time, I'll add. But it was going in and out again, and it was like, okay, this is something that I hadn't really considered. But I really enjoyed trying to find ways of surfacing things which had multiple layers, different color combinations, and also print, which was I really wanted to keep within the work. So I finished that 2 years, and I went to St Martin's to finish my degree in central London. Again, learned an awful lot at Central St Martin's, fantastic course. Came out of there, hit the road, you know, decided that's it. I'm brilliant now. I must be brilliant. I'm just going to be able to do this forever. But you kind of then lose the ability to use the facilities, which I hadn't really considered. So where I was going in and making up screens to do print with, all of a sudden I didn't have a screen printing option. So I started to sort of experiment with other ways of working on a surface in an analog kind of way, which then took me on to a master's because I felt that I hadn't learned everything I needed to learn. So I went to the Royal College in 2014, graduated in 2016, and I spent most of my 2 years there experimenting with print, and surface. So that's sort of how I've come to this point. So after I left there, had a really good degree show, got some great opportunities, sort of continue with those opportunities, and it just snowballs from there on. And I'm still even now experimenting with color and print, and each week I try other things. So I'm always looking for ways to have that immediacy of working in a very immediate way. So a little bit like when you're doing a two-dimensional collage, you kind of pull things from different places and add and take away. It was very much like that. So that's where my work really sits, and that's the bit I enjoy the most, really. So
Very
that's sort of how I am where I am now.
cool. Thanks so much for sharing that. You know, when I look at your work, your clay work, it really seems to be kind of a, as I mentioned earlier, kind of a juxtaposition between this dark clay that you work with and then this smooth, brightly colored slips and colors and stuff. Can you tell us a bit more about that process? Like, how did you come up with that? What do you do with that?
Well, I'm a big fan of old slipware, which I find really charming more than anything, actually. And I like the idea of using clay that isn't precious, I think is the word that I would use. I kind of like its raw edges. I like the feel of terracotta. I love it when you fire it super high and it goes a really beautiful, rich, sort of dark brown. And then you've got this. It's very difficult to add color onto that surface. So I started sort of introducing, basically, it's slip, you know, introducing slip onto terracotta and then coloring those slips creates this really vibrant, I think, a sort of juxtaposition, I think, of this very matte, dirty surface with a super shiny glazed surface. For me, just always, it reminds me of old buildings. And when you're walking past the window, it goes from, you know, dirty brick, especially in London, dirty brick into glass, into dirty brick into glass. And that sort of penetrates, I think, when you're living. I don't live in the city, but I spend quite a lot of time there. So you kind of can't help that just filters in. So for me, having that complete opposite is quite exciting.
Yeah, for me. Yeah, I can see why. How do you balance the use of color with the other elements of design, like form and texture and so on in your piece?
I don't tend to use much texture. I allow the clay to provide its own texture. So sometimes I'll use a very groggy clay and sometimes use a smooth clay. I think it just depends on where I'm at the moment. I'll switch between different clays. The color is more about what I've seen. I'm a bit of a sort of flaneur in that way, and I'll sort of walk around streets wandering aimlessly and allow it to soak in. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of come back and I'm an avid sketchbooker. I'm constantly drawing and painting in my sketchbook and sketching in my sketchbook. And so what I'll tend to do is I cut out a little window in a piece of card. And I kind of move it around the sketches that I've done, and I'll sort of see different colors and it becomes more abstract. And so it's rather than it being a drawing of something in particular, it becomes a section of that drawing, which I then kind of recreate onto the surfaces using those colors, really. I will take a little bit of artistic license and change things around a little bit. Ultimately, I will like the way the colours are positioned or the way that the composition is working, and then I transfer that. It's quite difficult onto 3D because you're constantly moving the vessel around to sort of make sure it works on all those angles, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I think when I've seen your work, it's a two-dimensional photograph. So we're only seeing a portion of it. Are your colours all the way around the piece? Or
yes.
Just on one. Okay.
Yeah, they were all the way around.
That's a very interesting thing. I was, as you were talking about cutting out a hole out of a piece of paper, that makes me think of landscape artists who may pull that kind of a process up in the landscape to find that piece that they want to paint.
Yeah. And I think it does make it quite abstract in that sense. So it's very difficult to explain. You know, if I've been to, I don't know, York or somewhere, and someone says, why is this York? You know, and I'm sort of, well, that's a good question. Because, and then when I go through the process and tell them the process, they, I get it, you know, and they can see maybe the colours will reflect what I've seen in that city or a certain part of that city.
Absolutely. So you've taken a piece of your sketch of the place, and that becomes the sketch, as I might say it, on the work itself.
Absolutely.
So you use some really bright colors, which I love those. But I wonder if you could tell us about any challenges that you faced in working with color in ceramics, like how you overcame those challenges.
A lot of the time, I'm looking for. Well, it depends. I think color can be sort of two things. The first is there's a very flat color. Almost like a gouache, where there's, you know, if you're working in paint, it's a very flat, one solid color, which can have, you know, underglazes will work like that. But for me, that sometimes is not enough. So, and I've just actually finished a piece that's in greens, which I find very difficult to work with green. And yet there's probably about six different greens that make up the block of the color. That took me a long time to break out of just this flat color. So that was about finding, you know, what I might do is I'll start with a base slip green. And then I learned quite quickly that you've got to be careful how much stain you add to slips, because I sometimes, well, early on, I was getting a lot of bubbling and a lot of crawling, and because I was just overloading it so much. But I think over time you learn to understand your palette and understand how to mix those palettes. So some I know that I can only add up to 5% of something, whereas some another color I might be able to add 15%. So you kind of learn those things as you go along, and it is about experimenting. I do a lot of experimenting. And the same when it comes to drawing over the top of those as well. So I may get all the flat, the flat colors, if I call them that, the big block colors, and then I'll put subtle color on top. And some of those subtle colors don't like other colors. And that's just, one of those things you learn and it destroys you a little bit, especially if you really like the piece and it comes off and it's crawled off or it's peeled off. But you kind of work around it, all those, every time you have a problem, you can sort of work around it by starting off from where you were before and then adapting what you've done. So there is a lot of testing. There are a lot of sometimes some mistakes because you can get a bit overzealous when you're working in such a fluid way. You kind of forget that that didn't work with that last time. So, I do have some howlers.
It is a lot of practice though, isn't it? And
Sure.
I think that, I listen to people in other worlds, like musicians and so on, who, advise people to practice deliberately and to practice deeply. I was thinking of Anna Vidovich, who's a classical guitar player, and she said that we have to work on our technique all our life. And given that you're at the top of your artistic game, how do you practice your, we've kind of been touching on that a little bit. How do you practice color and surface design?
What I tend to do is whenever I put a kiln load on, I will always take some of the palette that I've got, and then I will meticulously paint them over the top of each other in different ways. I might paint an orange over a green or a green over an orange, and I'll mark what I've done. I'll mark those test tiles, if you like, and I fire them at in exactly the same way as the work that I'm firing at that time. So every time I fire something, I've always got something in there that I'm testing. So I'm, for example, I've made up a printing ink that is a little bit risque because it's made with oil. And I you know, that could throw everything out. So I'm sort of a bit careful now. So I did a lot of tests on different things, printed onto slip, printed onto underglaze, printed onto stains, printed onto pretty much every permutation that I use to create those colors, and then glaze them all. And you sort of very quickly learn which you can do that with. So, I can't, for example, print onto the top of a very highly stained slip because for some reason the oil base of the ink doesn't like the thick slip underneath, and it will go a very mucky, greeny, sort of nasty color. But it won't, and it will also blister the glaze. So you kind of, each time I've introduced something new, I will test it methodically,
It's
which I think a lot of professional potters do as a matter of course anyway, because you spend a lot of time making objects, and the last thing you want to do is just chance it. And throw it in the bin when it comes out the kiln, because that's happened a lot.
Yeah, me too. Me too. In fact, that was one of the things that stimulated my desire to do this podcast, was because often we make the form and then we've got to apply the finish to it, and that can create lots of stress and anxiety about the whole thing. And one of the things that crossed my mind as I was listening to you was how our customers or our audience often doesn't understand, because they don't see it, all of the hours and the heartache that goes into testing and trying and all of those things that you're talking about.
Oh, they know that's one of the questions. If I'm doing a show, a public show, then that is probably one of the things that people ask me the most. How do you do that? And it isn't so much as that. It's not just one thing. There's probably seven or eight different processes involved. in creating this surface. So, you can go online and you can find potters that love showing how they do stuff, and they're not camera shy, and they're quite happy to tell you what they do. And I think all potters are very generous with their how they do things, because I remember as a student, I would be asking those questions as I was going around the show. So most potters have been in that position, and it's not just an art form, it's a science as well. So that science side crops up quite a lot. And that's the bit when it's all very well if you're working in 2D with paper and pencils, you can easily rub things out and scribble them off. But when you're working in three dimensions and it's having to go through like volcanic temperatures, there's a lot of science there.
No kidding.
And you start explaining to people that buy your work, and they do are very appreciative of you giving the information. They're, very, I tend to find that most people that talk to me really want to know. It's not sort of lip service. They really are interested in how you do stuff. And I think the more complicated things are, the more interested they are too. So I'm always forthcoming about how I do things.
Cool. You know, you've talked about you learning, particularly around the chemistry and science of clay and ceramics. I wonder if there are any specific artists, either in the ceramics world or other artistic disciplines, whose use of color has really had a profound impact on your work, that they've influenced.
One artist in particular that I really admired, when I first started using color, was, I don't know if you've heard of Lauren Mabry. She's an American artist.
I have, for
And
sure.
I've watched her sort of career and her new, as her work evolves. And I do sit in awe of her work because she's also, not just block color now, everything, the color's moving. Some of the work that she produces now are like sculptural pieces where the clay is actually the sculpture and the glaze becomes this part of this great sculpture. So I do look at her work, and also the scale of her work sometimes can be really impressive. And I'd love to work on that scale. I just don't have the room to work on that scale. Everyone's sort of a bit bound by what space they've got. I'm bound by what kilns I've got. So I can only work to a certain scale. But her work in particular has really kind of really has profoundly affected me. But the other person as well is Picasso, bizarrely. Picasso's ceramic work is outstanding. I was really fortunate when I was at the RCA to have, I think it was Christie's, the auction house, came to the RCA and wanted to photograph the work of Picasso that they'd got for auction in our studios. And so I was really fortunate to be able to see these things and handle them, close up. And they are so simple and beautiful, and the line making and the mark making is spectacular. And probably some of the most simplest things that I've ever seen, but the most effective. So sometimes I do feel like I just want to do one line and that's it. And that is something that I'm getting better at now, pulling back a little bit, because I can sometimes be a bit too exuberant, and I do know that.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying doing less is sometimes more.
I think the quality of the line is super important. It's about that expression that you get in just one brush mark or two brush marks. A bit like Cy Twombly as well, his color palette, amazing paintings. So I think I'm probably more inspired by painters. And some of the St. Ives group, I particularly like some of their landscape work, and Patrick Heron. So I think most of the work that I really admire, their use of color, was probably the abstract expressionist period, where they were using block color, but somehow the line quality was exceptional for me. It was exceptional, yeah.
Yeah, that really makes it pop, doesn't it? You can have that, as you call it, that flat color surface, but the
Yeah.
line that you might put in the piece really draws the eye to it.
It does. And again, when you're working with clay, it's much more difficult to create those lines. So you kind of find you end up with certain tools that you've found or you've worked with. For example, I use a porcupine quill quite a lot to draw those lines because it's slightly bendy. And I tend to do, I'm right-handed, but I tend to make the marks with my left hand. So I'm a little bit more out of control. And the lines create themselves then. So I'm not controlling it, which can be really, really interesting when that happens. You do get some marks that you go, I could never have done that because I think the pressure's too much when you're trying to create this certain line. So if you take the pressure away, close your eyes, or do it with your left hand, you always get something much more exciting.
Yeah, for
That's
sure.
the,
For sure.
yeah.
I agree completely. I was thinking
Yeah.
about in my world, sometimes if I'm using my right hand, I'll get what I call tight, and I don't want to be tight. So I really relate to what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I do that quite a lot actually. Actually, I would say more so because I can draw very, normally like an artist can draw, but I don't particularly like those drawings. The ones I like the most are my sketches, the ones that I haven't had that precious moment with. They're very loose, they're very free, and they're more me, I think. They're that subconscious side of you that just comes out when you're not really looking or concentrating. They're the ones I like the most.
Yeah, very cool. The spirit comes out in that way.
I think
Yeah,
so.
very cool. Hey, I was thinking, but we've talked a lot here today already about your technique and how you do things and how you approach your work. And I wonder what advice you might have for a young ceramic artist or maybe an older one who's starting out, but what advice have you got for a budding ceramic artist, we'll call it that, who's just starting to develop their own unique style?
I think one of my tutors once said to me that it was important that I was having fun. And I never really thought about that very much until I started making for myself properly, for myself as an artist. And you have to have fun while you're doing it because I think it becomes a job otherwise. And I don't really want a job if that. So I don't know what that makes me sound like, but
No, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
I kind of love doing what I'm doing and the freedom of doing it. And I mean, from a psychological point of view, when I come into my studio and I shut the door and I switch on the heater and I put my radio on, I'm in my own space. I mean, my head goes into, the space I need it to go in. It just does. And the worrying side of my brain and the daily side of my brain just switches off. And then the other side of my brain, I think, just switches on and concentrates on what I'm doing. And so I don't get bogged down by everyday stuff. So if you're a ceramicist or you a wannabe ceramicist or just a hobby potter or working with clay, I think there's an innate knowledge that happens when you pick up clay. It just is there. It's born with you. There's a sense that you get when you work with it. And it unlocks a part of your brain and it gives your other side of the brain a rest. So any potter that's out there thinking it's not for me, even if they just play with a ball of clay, I think that's beneficial to their mental state as well. I just think it's the best thing for them to do, keep picking up the clay, keep making, and allowing yourself to keep making and allowing yourself to keep making mistakes because you will find what it is you're looking for at some point. And it's great fun when you do. It's like revelationary.
And
So.
It's really a balance, I think, between knowing the technical side enough so that it works. Like you're talking about, what temperature do I put it at, and what, how much stain do I put in the slip? I'll call it kind of the technical piece. With this freedom that you're talking about, this joy, this sense of allowing the spirit to come out, and it's about allowing both to happen at the same time, ultimately.
Yeah, I think so. You, when I've done run classes in the past, I have people from all walks of life in their classes, and from nurses to teachers to, well, pretty much any retired, right across the board. I mean, I've got a young 18-year-old, and they sort of come to you with their daily troubles, and by the time they've left 3 hours later, you can see that spirit has been allowed to come alive in the classroom. And they will sit and make, and some will sit very quietly and they're happy in their little making zone, and others create this, they've got an aura about them where it's excitement. And as a tutor, that is something that really excites me. And they come to me for the technical advice. So the technical advice can be learned by books, and I think everybody can learn that technical side. Me personally, I was the pain in the backside for all the technicians at the universities because I just followed them around. Like, what are you doing? How are you loading that kiln? What temperature is that? And I think I drove them a little bit nuts, to be fair. But all that knowledge goes in, and now I'm giving that knowledge out to the students. So you can learn it out of a book, but not, it's much better when you practice it, I think.
Very
And
cool.
learn by those mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll put a notification of your website and so on up in the podcast. But I guess given what you just said, some people might say, "Hey, does she teach? And can I go and take classes with her?" So that's my question. Do you teach? Can people come and take classes with you?
I did up until about 2 years ago. I was running classes from my studio, and I was keeping people sane during COVID when we were allowed to mingle. So I basically opened up the class for three at a time, so that they could socially distance and for their mental health a lot more than anything. And I taught those for quite some time, and I gave them basically, I had to stop the teaching about, I think, just over a year ago now, because I got too busy and I was, running out of kiln space, not getting any of my work done. And so it became a point where I was at a balancing point, and I was like, my work's being affected now, so I have to like put that on hold. So I mean, I'm doing a talk, demonstration talk, in about 3 weeks' time, where I do demonstrate some of the processes that I use and talk about my work. And that's in a place in England called St Albans at the Decorum and Chilton Potters Group. So we have quite a lot of those groups in England, scattered sort of all over the country. So I'll very often go and do one of those for them, so that those people that know me that want to learn how to, do the work can actually go to those demonstrations. So at the moment, I am not teaching.
Okay, so nobody call you,
Well,
except look out for your workshops, because you might be putting on a workshop nearby that
it's
way.
more like a sort of talk. So you sort of do a talk demonstration, really. So I sort of talk about some of the, I'll take my sketchbooks along, and I take how I get inspired, how I work out what I'm going to do onto a vessel. And then I'll show them some of the techniques on a half-built vessel, so they can sort of see how to do them, at what stage you add slip to the pot, or how you would paint onto some newspaper and use that like a carbon paper, and using sort of stencil techniques. So I kind of go through that for about an hour with them as well. So they sort of go away going, oh, I'm going to try that,
That'd be
which,
fun. Yeah,
I've
absolutely.
done my job if people go away thinking that. So
Well, I think people are going to go away from listening to you speak today on our podcast. Really excited about some of the work that you're doing. And I want to just say a big thank you for participating here today. It's been wonderful meeting you and learning more about your work and how you think and how you let your spirit out. So that's pretty cool.
So thank you, Bob. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. And good luck with the rest of your podcasts.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.